The intense Kavanaugh confirmation battle culminates. This hour, why more than 2,400 U.S. law professors say no. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll hear from one of about a dozen law professors here in Iowa who believe Kavanaugh has neither the temperament nor the impartiality to sit on the nation's highest court. Also this hour, ISU economist Chad Hart on how trade disruptions are impacting the Midwest, a German writer with Saudi roots in residency in the state, and a conversation with Governor Kim Reynolds. Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. While the intense battle over the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh is culminating, both of our U.S. senators are solid yes votes. Here's Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley speaking to reporters yesterday alongside other committee Republicans.
This person is very well qualified. A person that believes in the principles of due process, the presumption of innocence, and readiness to serve are recognized. So Judge Kavanaugh should be confirmed on Saturday.
Well, at least 2,400 professors of law in the United States have signed a letter published in the New York Times saying no to this confirmation, saying that Brett Kavanaugh did not display the impartiality and judicial temperament requisite to sit on the highest court of our land. Joining me now, one of those professors who signed, Paul Gauder, professor of law at the University of Iowa. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, at least 10 other professors in Iowa, professors of law in Iowa, have also signed this letter. Why did you feel compelled to sign it?
So for me, the key really shocking thing about the nomination hearings was about 6 minutes of Judge Kavanaugh's opening statement at the Senate, where he stopped talking about the evidence relating to these very serious allegations against him and just started making these astonishing claims about coordinated political attacks on the basis of revenge from the Clintons. I mean, he essentially asserted a conspiracy theory in the Democratic Party. And for me, that type of reaction, even to very serious allegations, is not consistent with the demeanor or the nonpartisan approach that we expect from a federal judge at any level.
Mm-hmm. To you as a law professor, but is there any underpinning for a demeanor that is needed in our Constitution?
Oh, not in our Constitution, but so I'll give you an example. The Code of Conduct for United States Judges specifically requires judges to be nonpartisan. It requires them to act in such a way as to promote confidence in the integrity and in the impartiality of the judiciary. The American Bar Association's Model Code of Conduct for Judges says the same things. I mean, every principle that we've written into our ethical standards for judges in this country is inconsistent with blatant partisan attacks and conspiracy theorizing.
Mm-hmm. Also mentioned in this letter that you signed, along with at least 2,400 law professors in the U.S., temperament is mentioned?
Exactly. Well, temperament is mentioned in terms of demeanor, right? So what the codes of ethics focus on is the public conduct of judges. And again, the idea is that judges are obliged to promote confidence in their impartiality and their ability to make decisions without favoring one side or the other, without having their politics involved. And so demeanor isn't specifically mentioned in these ethics codes, but the idea of what a judge should be that underlies these ethics codes is they should remain calm and focused on the facts rather than reacting from anger or, you know, telling stories about conspiracies.
We have just a few seconds left. Can you tell us why we should believe your opinion, this opinion of the other law professors, why is this anything more than just partisan politics, which we've had plenty of in this discussion?
Oh, absolutely. Partisan politics is an issue. But the real issue is, you know, this is not like nobody would say this about Justice Gorsuch, for example.
You didn't say this.
I didn't say this about Justice Gorsuch. Nobody said this about Justice Gorsuch. Even those of us, I mean, I disagree with Justice Gorsuch's politics, but I respect his integrity as a judge.
Paul Gauder, professor of law at the University of Iowa. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The U.S., Canada, and Mexico struck a new trade deal to replace NAFTA. That was last weekend. The three countries still have to approve it. It's known as the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or the acronym USMCA. Now, the three countries reached a consensus after more than a year of talks. And if you remember, this all began after President Trump made good on his campaign promise to renegotiate the nearly 25-year-old North America Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. This is being called NAFTA 2.0 by some. Major changes on cars, new policies on labor, environmental standards, intellectual property protection, some digital trade provisions. U.S. farmers would get more access to the Canadian dairy market as well. Well, joining us to give us some context on the news of this new trade deal, yet to be approved, as I mentioned, Chad Hart is with us, Associate Professor of Economics, Crop Markets Specialist, and Extension Economist at Iowa State University, joining us from Ames. Hi, Chad.
How you doing, Ben?
I'm doing well. So what are your major takeaways for Iowa and the Midwest should this be approved?
Well, probably the biggest takeaway is it creates trade certainty, if you will. As you mentioned, a lot of this has some carryover from the old NAFTA agreement. And so a lot of the rules that govern most of the trade for Iowa, if you will, stay the same. And so that's what it does for a lot of Iowa agriculture, as you mentioned. Probably the biggest new change would be the opening up of the Canadian dairy market. And so we will see some additional dairy sales because of that. But like I say, in total, the idea is what this does is it mainly confirms and holds in place the trade rules that U.S. and Iowa farmers have been living under for the past 24 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's take that specific example since we pointed that out as a highlight. The dairy market in Canada protects its dairy market, has up to this point. Let's say I'm a dairy farmer here in Iowa. What advantage can I look to?
Well, in this case, what we'd be looking for are a few more export sales to Canada as they loosen up their restrictions on what they allowed, what products they allowed into the country. You know, in this case, the Canadian dairy trade-off here was that they gave us more access to their dairy market. We, in turn, the U.S., gave them more access to our sugar and peanut markets. And so in any agreement like this, it's always a trade-off, a compromise, and that's where the two countries came together here.
Mm-hmm. Aside from dairy, any other standouts that Midwesterners should know about?
Well, I think the other big ones you sort of mentioned in your lead up here, the idea is that, you know, one of the big things that was missing from the old NAFTA agreement was basically the digital economy. And so we did see some substantive write-up there that, you know, put rules in place that could guide Midwestern companies as they look forward to, you know, participating and continuing to grow the digital economy.
Mm-hmm. So away from this specific trade deal announced last weekend, let's talk about the disruptions in the trade economies around the world that have been caused by, well, getting to this point. This is just for North America, but of course we've been having a more aggressive trade policy under this administration now that affects many countries. You recently worked on a study, a Center for Agricultural and Rural Development study that looked how current disruptions to trade have affected Iowa's economy. Tell us what you found.
What we basically found was that we're looking at about a 0.5% to 1% hit on the state's gross state product, if you will, or, you know, the state economy. And that was spread throughout the state. You know, agriculture is one of the areas where we've seen the largest losses due to these trade disruptions, but you also see it impacting other sectors of the Iowa economy. In this case, for example, primary metals would gain based upon these trade disruptions. You know, steel and aluminum tariffs do protect the domestic industry here. On the flip side, Places that use imported steel and aluminum face some cost. And when we add those all together across the entire Iowa economy, we find that, yeah, there's a net loss to us through these trade disruptions.
Mm-hmm. In terms other than percentage, or do you have dollar terms?
Dollar terms would be about $1 to $2 billion.
Okay. And primarily from the losses?
Primarily from the losses of, again, agriculture would be for your biggest sector of losses. Manufacturing, especially those sectors like John Deere, Winnebago, where they tend to use imported metals, they have losses there as well. Your big gainers would be, for example, the Alcoa plant and the steel manufacturer over in eastern Iowa would gain from the trade and basically the tariffs that have been put in place over the past few months.
Right. Are these losses calculated with a certain time frame in mind?
Well, you can think of the $2 billion number would be closer to, you know, what's happened so far today. But markets adjust once we know the trade rules, if you will. Yeah. Players adjust. We adjust trade flows. And you tend to see less loss over time. And so we would say that the large loss estimates, that's what you face in the short term. Over the longer term, we would tend to move back towards that $1 billion loss.
Mm-hmm. Critics of Donald Trump's aggressive trade policies have said, well, once you lose trade deals, your partners go elsewhere. They find the commodities, whatever they need to buy. It's really hard to get them back. How valid is that argument?
It's somewhat valid. The idea is that you do tend to lose market share when you have these trade disputes. What you're relying on is that while you're losing market share with those countries, you're trying to pick up market share in other places. And I think that's, if you will, what we're watching to see happen here. For mm-hmm. example, with soybeans, China was a big buyer, a tariff put in place that created a massive disruption to that market. The U.S. is now searching for other countries that can possibly pick up some of the slack, if you will, with the departure of China from that market.
Mm-hmm. I've heard supporters of these aggressive trade policies talk about, well, use the phrase, short-term pain for long-term gain. Can you buy into that at all?
I can buy into some of it. The idea is that we will see some gains, but it's also one of these deals of, especially within agriculture, what tends to happen is when we go through this short-term pain, we still see some longer-term, if you will, loss as well. And I think that's one of the biggest issues that farmers have been worried about as they've watched this disruption, is that they've been through periods of trade disruptions like this before, and found that while, you know, the industry has continued to grow and build, it's not quite on the growth path that it once was.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if in your position, Chad, as extension economist at Iowa State University, you can tell us anything about the mood of farmers amid these trade wars.
I would describe it as concerned, but the idea is that they're willing to sort of, you know, see where this is going to end up. In talking with producers, especially with the dispute with China, they are in agreement with the administration on the issues that, you know, sort of surround this debate between the U.S. and China. What they are concerned about or may disagree with would be the techniques the administration has used to try to create changes in that trade relationship.
So aside from North America, this agreement that's apparently been made, and what you've said about China, what other trade negotiations have been disrupted or are in the works?
Well, we've got several in the works. When we look at, you know, just over the past year to year and a half, we've had the renegotiation of the CORUS agreement, the agreement between the U.S. and South Korea in terms of trade. We have seen the U.S. and both the European Union and Japan reach out together to start bilateral trade discussions here. And there's even been some talk about, you know, revisiting the Pacific Trade Partnership. And so you are seeing, if you will, the sort of the flip side of this. As President Trump was running as candidate Trump, he said that he would look to negotiate better trade deals. We're beginning to see movement on that negotiating strategy, again, with USMCA sort of leading the charge here, but there have been several other countries in those discussions as well.
Okay. Chad Hart, thanks for the overview. Associate Professor of Economics, Crop Markets Specialist, and Extension Economist at ISU in Ames. Chad, thanks for coming into our studio.
Thank you very much.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 28 writers from 27 countries are currently in Iowa taking part in a residency at the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. And we've been getting to know them over the weeks since they arrived in, I guess that was late August. We've been listening to conversations that I had with several of them at a gathering to welcome the group of writers from around the world. Today, let's meet a writer from Germany.
My name is Rasha Hayat, and I come from Hamburg in Germany.
Okay, so not a typically German name. You grew up in Germany?
I did, actually. I was born in Germany. My father is actually from Saudi Arabia, and my parents met in Germany when my father was still a student. And my mother fell madly in love with this handsome Arabic doctor. I have no idea what persuaded her to get married, and then they had my brother and myself, and then we moved to Saudi Arabia, lived there for 10 years, and then my father was the person who decided that he didn't want to live there anymore, and we all moved back to Germany, and so I've lived in Germany now since 1989. Okay. So, yeah.
And you're a writer. What do you write about?
I write exactly about that, about the cross-cultural experience, about racism, everyday racism, about being a semi-colored or colored person in a mainly white society, and multiculturalism and the difficulties of it, and how people tend to tell you how amazing it is that you have all these experiences and that it's sometimes not that amazing because you get subjected to a lot of weird experiences.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your upbringing growing up Saudi in Hamburg.
Oh, I didn't grow up in Hamburg. I moved to Hamburg after university to start a job. I grew up in what we call the Ruhrgebiet, which is an industrial region in Germany. It's in the west, right in the middle. It used to be the coal mining center of Germany. And this is where I grew up. We moved there because my maternal grandparents are from there, lived there. So we lived in the same town with them. And it was a cultural shock, I guess, coming from Saudi Arabia, from a massive family. I just told someone that the last wedding I went to last year had 600 people in them.
And they're all related to you?
Probably 599 of them are related to me. Apart from the groom, hopefully. Although you never know. So we moved to Germany, and it was a small family. Suddenly, only two cousins, as opposed to 50 on the other side of the globe. Cold weather, strange children who had strange reference systems, I guess.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, imagine that you go to school and to kindergarten in a place where, you have all kinds of experience. You have games that you play, you have songs that you sing that you grow up with, you have TV shows that you watch maybe, and foods that you like, and it's never the big political things, it's these things that make you feel alienated. So you're 10 years old, you come into a new school, and you have absolutely no idea what the other children are talking about. They're playing games you've never played. They're singing songs you've never heard of. The references they make of books, of TV shows, of what are completely alien to you. And you're the one who's trying to fit in. And
How do you think that shaped you when you look back?
Oh, it completely shaped me. It completely defines me, I guess, in a way.
How?
In a way that I think I learned very early to be sort of a chameleon, to kind of adapt very easily to situations that are not familiar to me. And because it was my main goal not to draw any attention to me, because that was the worst thing, to be singled out. Like, you have to spell your name all the time. You have to explain why you have the hair like this. Or when I was younger, I was even a bit more dark-skinned than I am now. So you try not to be singled out, so you kind of try to be adaptable to any kind of situation. And I guess that's a good social skill to have, but it also provides you with a very good sense of observation. I guess you observe people very closely because you need to observe them in order to copy them and to adapt. And I guess that's something that comes in very handy when you're a writer, when you want to observe and research and just watch and listen. And so I guess that shaped me in a way that I'm very attentive to detail. Mm-hmm.
So these 3 months here in Iowa, how will you use it? What's appealing to you about being in this setting at this time for you as a writer in developing your skill?
I think the main thing that is going to be very interesting and hopefully very fruitful is the exchange with the colleagues. It's with what everybody does. Everybody does so many cool things in their own countries and so many different things like drama and mixed media and essays and fiction and poetry. And you never get the opportunity to have an exchange with this kind of group of writers from all over the world that do so many eclectic things for such a long time. I mean, usually you would go to a festival maybe for two or three days and you would meet maybe 10 people from different parts of Europe maybe, and that's always nice. But to have the privilege to be for 3 months in a setting as beautiful as this and that just caters to writing and to people who love books and people who love words, it's I have never heard anything like it, and it's I'm looking forward to it.
So this is you. This very interesting, Rasha. This very interesting mix of German culture and Saudi culture. Tell us something about Saudi Arabia we don't know, perhaps here in Iowa. Something in the news lately. Of course, not too long ago, Saudi women are now allowed to drive.
Well, I mean, I'm really glad that Saudi is getting some good news for a change. Because for the longest time, people would, when you say you come from Saudi Arabia, people would cringe. And they would, you know, talk about terrorism, of course, and about 9/11 and all these things. So
yeah, almost all of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia.
Exactly. And about fundamental Islam and all that kind of stuff. So I'm actually kind of happy that now is getting some good publicity. What we don't know about Saudi Arabia, and I'm not sure how it's in the state, but in my work, when I talk about it in public speaking in Germany and in Europe, people are always surprised when I say that you have two Saudi Arabias. So you have the outside and you have the inside. You have inside of the house, which is completely opposite of what is outside of the house. The inside couldn't be more loving and more open and more generous and more emotional towards families, towards strangers, and welcoming, and like really warm and environment, and nurturing also in a way. Even if they don't understand what you do, they're just like, yeah, welcome, come on, eat one of the 50 dishes I just cooked for you. And that always broke my heart that it has such a bad rap for being weird and extremist and segregated. And so that's why I'm really happy that it kind of gets there. But I wouldn't want to live there, so don't get me wrong.
So I can't help but notice a wonderful, a beautiful tattoo on your forearm. Would you mind telling me what that is?
It's an Arabic calligraphy. It says Hayat, and that means life. It's actually quite cheesy, but but I just like it, and it just reminds me of it reminds me of someone, and it reminds me of the fact that actually I had a friend who had that name. It's a girl's name as well, and she passed away a few years ago. So, and the name means life. So the fact that her name has that meaning, and it's on my left arm, which is obviously connected to the heart. So I thought I would get her name tattooed as a calligraphy on my arm, just to remind me that living every day is a good thing and not to plan too far ahead and to sort of live in the moment kind of thing. It's very cheesy, but I love it.
I don't think it's cheesy.
No, thank you.
Rasha, thank you very much for this short conversation. I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
A German writer with Saudi roots, Rasha Kayat, currently in residency in the state, hosted by the International Writers Program at the University of Iowa. Coming up, a longer version of the conversation my colleague Clay Masters had with Governor Kim Reynolds. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, about a month before the midterm election, and this election season, we're featuring conversations with major party congressional candidates in Iowa races, as well as the candidates in the gubernatorial race. We've heard from gubernatorial candidates from the Democratic and Libertarian parties, Fred Hubble, he was yesterday, and Jake Porter before that. Today, we hear the longer version of the interview Clay Masters did with Governor Kim Reynolds.
Clay started by asking Governor Reynolds how she's preparing for the debates coming up with her and Democratic challenger Fred Hubble.
Well, I get a lot of practice because, you know, I do press conferences and meet with media all the time, and I travel all across the state. So I believe we have a great story to tell, and I'm looking forward to having that conversation with Iowans to talk about how we are the number one state in the country and how we got there. And it has a lot to do with our people, our work ethic, our values, and Iowans and businesses who are making a difference in communities all across the state. So I'm anxious to talk about some of the things we've done in the last couple of legislative sessions, but what I'm excited about working on moving forward.
And as far as priorities in the 2019 legislative session, should you be elected to your first full term, what are your priorities?
Well, we're going to continue to grow the economy, and we're seeing great growth right now. We want to make sure that that's happening in every single corner of the state. We're going to be investing in Iowans with workforce training because we have jobs looking for people right now, and what an amazing opportunity that is for Iowans all across the state. And so with Future Ready Iowa, we'll be putting the money into that so we can actually implement it. We've put the infrastructure in place this year, and we are rocking and rolling and ready to go with 18 summits all across the state. So the momentum is good, and I'm really looking forward to helping Iowans get the skills to have a great job and to have that job here in Iowa. We're going to continue to invest in our greatest asset, our children. You know, I'm a mom and a grandmother of soon-to-be 10 grandchildren and a mom of a teacher. And so I know how critically important it is that we invest in education, and we're preparing our students for the innovative digital age that we live in today, and we're going to continue to invest in children. The other thing we'll do is I'm really going to invest in an integrated, sustainable healthcare system, and we've made a lot of good progress, but we've got a lot of work to do. Proud of what we did with mental health, comprehensive mental health care reform, unanimously passed in the legislature. We had several initiatives that did that, and then the children's executive order that I passed.
As far as education leaders have said that K through 12 spending is not keeping up with inflation. Do you feel that Iowa is doing an adequate job of funding K through 12 schools?
Well, I'm proud of my historic investment in K-12 education. We're fourth highest in the country. There are only three other states in America that have invested at a higher rate in K-12 education than Iowa. We're eighth in teacher salaries, $765 million of new money since 2011. In addition to that, it's about 46% of our budget, so $3.2 billion going into K-12 education. And we have a nationally recognized STEM initiative, science, technology, engineering, and math, which is really helping our young people be prepared for the jobs of today and the jobs of tomorrow. They're growing three times faster than non-related jobs, and that's how we're going to remain competitive and innovative as a state. And so I'm proud of what we've been able to do, especially during some tough budget times. You know, it was a Democratic-controlled governor and Democratic-controlled legislature that actually cut K-12 education 10% across the board cut, but not only K-12 education, higher education, public health, public safety, 10% across the board cut. I didn't cut K-12 education. I held them harmless in two really tough budget cycles. We did not. We put more money in every year to make sure that we're investing in our greatest asset, our children.
So you would say so far adequately funded?
You know, we're always going to try to do more, but I have to work with the revenue that I'm given. I have to balance the budget. I can't print money like they can in Washington, D.C. I have to have a balanced budget. And I made it a priority. I think we demonstrated that over the 2 years in really tough budget times. We increased funding, and we didn't cut K-12 education, so I think that's really important.
Last week, the Revenue Estimating Conference put out a larger number than expected as far as the surplus, $127 million. How did the numbers get so far off? What do your folks say, and what do you point to as reasons why that would be so far off?
Well, I'm excited that, again, the budget is balanced. Our cash reserves, our savings account, the cash reserves and the economic emergency fund are full. And we have more money than we did when I took office in 2011. So I think it's a reflection of an economy that's growing. It's a reflection of tax cuts. It's a reflection of wages. Iowans are seeing more money in their pockets. For the last three quarters straight, Iowans have seen an increase in incomes. Last quarter of 2017, 4.5%, first quarter of 18, 5%, and then the second quarter of 2018, a 5.1% increase. And I think it's sixth or seventh in the country. So, you know, that's something that we should be proud of. We had a lot of variables as we went into this last budgeting cycle. First of all, there had been the federal tax cuts that had been passed, which has been a great stimulant for not only Iowans, but virtually every Iowan is seeing more money in their paychecks, but also for businesses, and that we're seeing them reinvest in Iowans and in their companies. But we needed to kind of watch that to see how that would impact Iowa's revenues by some of the choices that they were making. In addition to that, we were watching trade really closely. And so we were unsure on how that would impact revenues for the state of Iowa. But so that's what I'm sure the Revenue Estimating Conference was taking into account. I mean, they're the ones that set the numbers. But I think we're seeing a reflection of those numbers, again, in the economy that's growing, Iowans seeing more money in their pockets. And it's, I think, tax cuts and reductions in regulations and, you know, an optimism that we're seeing in the state is having an impact.
Does it maybe signal that the surplus would indicate that maybe there are certain government agencies or services that have been underfunded and that money can be allocated differently?
Well, we're going to have an opportunity to go into the next legislative session, hopefully in a better place than we've been the last two. And with the phenomenal trade news that we've gotten this week, I mean, that is really going to help things also. Right now, our biggest barrier to economic growth is workforce. There's not a day go by that I don't talk to business leaders across this state that says business has never been better, projecting growth, optimistic about the future. We just need workforce. And so and we're working on it every single day, as I indicated earlier. But once we get that need met, this economy will continue to explode. I think the Iowa Business Council just released their quarterly report, and they said this is the best economy in 10 years. Three quarters of them are expecting growth in the next 6 months. Half of them said they would be hiring additional workforce. And I think it was 60% said that they would be investing capital. So that's all really, really, really good news for Iowans.
Going back to education, yep. The University of Iowa slipped in the U.S. News World Report down a few rankings. President Bruce Harreld had said something about state government needing to step up more and provide more services to help further student achievement. Do you agree that the state needs to step up and provide more support to keep Iowa's Regents Universities from slipping in the rankings?
Well, we appreciate our Regents. They are some of the best in the country, and they've been a partner in really growing our economy, especially with the research parks and how we're bringing business and industry to the campuses so that we can, you know, help. It's a win-win, not only for the businesses, it helps provide them with a workforce, but also we get to, partner with the talent and the expertise that our universities provide. We're working hard every single day to make sure that kids are prepared when they go into higher education. I was proud to be part of an administration that actually held college tuition. We froze it for 2.5 years. And we're making sure that kids, you know, we are the number one state for dual enrollment, which means kids are taking community college classes while they're in high school. And that's really helping them be more prepared and more likely to succeed as they transition into possibly a university or a four-year degree. So, you know, we had some tough budget times. Again, it was the Democratic-controlled governor and Democratic-controlled legislature that actually cut our universities, a 10% across the board cut. What we had to do, unfortunately, was a little under 2, and it was just a reflection of some really tough budget times. Every single agency has been experiencing the same thing. They have access to other resources, federal foundation dollars, and our K-12 schools didn't. And so we felt it was really important to hold K-12 harmless, and the rest of us had to look for opportunities to implement some efficiencies, and I think we all had a role to play in that. But as we grow the economy, you know, we're hoping we can do more.
Have you heard much from college students saying that it's more and more challenging to get paying those student bills? Are you hearing from students that are having a hard time even affording to get into college?
Well, that's why we're doing everything we can to keep the cost down, and that's why dual enrollment is we should be singing and encouraging more students to do that, and we are. There's not another state in the country that is taking dual enrollment community college classes while they're in high school, and that's helping keep the cost of higher education down. The other thing that we're doing is with the STEM initiative and with Future Ready Iowa, we're really working with students to help expose them to all the different opportunities that exist within Iowa and helping them find where they have a passion and helping them know that there are a lot of different paths to great careers. And you know what? Sometimes that's a certification. Sometimes that's an apprenticeship program. Sometimes that's a two-year or four-year degree. But let's find out where their interest is at, and then let's support that. And a lot of kids, even like an apprenticeship program that we're doing with the STEM Best, where we're partnering with community colleges, high schools, and a business, students are going right out of high school into a business. They're making great wages, benefits. They can actually earn some income while they're in high school. And the thing is, a lot of the kids that are doing that, they continue to advance in their career. Some of them are going on and becoming an engineer at one of our universities. So I think it's a great opportunity for kids to really, that's the time they should be testing and finding out where their passion is at. And that will help keep the cost of higher education down too, because they're going to be doing what they want to do and focused on what fits them.
One of the big issues during this campaign has been the privatization of Medicaid.
Yes.
The director, Mike Randall, of Medicaid recently pointed to a graph in a meeting showing per-member cost had been increasing faster than before it was under privatization. There were some Iowa poll results showing that support for Medicaid privatization is slipping among likely voters. Does that concern you?
Well, what I'm really focused on and what my priority for managed care is to be able to look parents in the eyes and assure them that there will be a sustainable program in place that will be able to take care of their loved one, not only today, but tomorrow and 10 years from now. And that wasn't the case with the old system. It absolutely was not sustainable, and that's why we transitioned to managed care 2 years ago, and it's why 39 other states have done the same thing, and virtually all of them will move in that direction. So I'm focused on making sure that I have a sustainable program. But it became very clear as I was traveling the state before I was sworn in as governor that there were problems with the system and it hadn't been rolled out properly. And I admitted that. And I have spent the last 16 months working every day to sustain this program, to stabilize and sustain it. I brought in new leadership, Director Foxhoven. I asked him to, as a fresh set of eyes, take a look at this and tell me if this is the direction we need to go or we need to do something different. He said, we need to stay with managed care. We need to make some changes. I brought in a new actuary so that both sides, all stakeholders, had confidence in the rates that were being certified. We brought in a new Medicaid director with Director Randall. I have another managed care provider that will be coming on soon. We're rolling him in slowly so they're prepared. And we're doing that right this time. And we put the money that was required into the system to sustain it. And why I feel comfortable about the money that we're putting into it when we did the renegotiation with the MCOs is because the actuary, first of all, that was their recommendation. That's an independent firm. And this time, we actually had 2 years of experience to base those numbers on instead of just projections. We had 150,000 individuals that had moved into the system with the health and wellness program. So it's actually based on experience. We know that's what the cost is going to be. In addition to that, it covers the comprehensive mental health care reform that we passed last year. Most importantly, this is the other thing I want providers to know. I am not going to continue to travel around this state and have doctors and physicians and nursing home providers that are providing these services for Iowans not get paid in a timely manner. I am not going to accept that. They know that. We've put financial penalties in the contract if they don't pay in a timely manner. We have oversight that the legislature passed last year if they don't pay in a timely manner. Now, sometimes there's reasons that they shouldn't, and we're going to continue to monitor that. And if I continue to see problems with that, we will put some more restrictions on it. We all have a role to play in taking care of our most vulnerable Iowans, and we're going to make sure that that's done. And here's the other thing. We have the lowest unemployment. We have jobs looking for people, yet we have 680,000 people that are in Medicaid So I'm willing to work with these Iowans to provide them the support system to help them get a skill, to match them up with a job, and to get them off Medicaid. And to help them, we can really focus those dollars on the individuals that need it.
How much of the population is able to do that, that are on Medicaid? I mean, I know a lot of times we talk about a very vulnerable population and disabled.
I don't know what percentage, but, you know, whatever it is, you know, we want to work with them and help them. They've had some, you know, life is tough. They've had some significant challenges. I get that. I've had some significant challenges in my life, and I believe that everybody deserves a second chance. And we're going to try it with a carrot. We're going to try working with them, giving them the support system that they need, helping provide some funding, and help get them, you know, the skills for a great job so that they can take care of themselves and their family. And that starts to take care of a lot of things. The other thing I want to just say really quick is that, again, 680,000 Iowans are covered under Medicaid. And for the bulk of those Iowans, they are so grateful for that service because it is complex and it is hard to maneuver in. So they are so appreciative of somebody helping to manage that, to helping make sure that they get an annual physical, that they're taking their medication, that we're identifying chronic illness sooner rather than later, cancer. I mean, so there are good things happening with that system. Is it perfect? No. I've admitted that, and I've worked the last 16 months to really stabilize it, turn it around, and help meet the needs of Iowans.
Staying on health care, recently the state's high court found Iowa Constitution strongly supports abortion rights, which makes it more likely that the fetal heartbeat bill might not hold up in court. Is a judicial nominee's position on abortion a major factor in your decisions for those kind of nominees?
I never asked that in the interview. I'm interested in a judge that will apply the law and not create it. That is a strict constitutionalist, and that's what I'm interested in.
And finally, the president is going to be in Iowa, or it's looking like he's going to be here next week.
I don't know if it's confirmed yet,
but we're seeing reports of that coming out. You've said in the past to me that the president's administration has been very open to talking with your administration. Are you planning on being with the president if he's here again? And are you, I mean, if you were to give the president a grade so far, what would you give him?
Well, look what we're seeing in Iowa. First of all, I appreciate the access. I've never seen anything like that. And as I meet with governors, Republican and Democrat, they'll tell you the same thing. Never have we seen the amount of access. Because they ask, you know, what can we do to work with the states? Can we get more to the states and let them make the decisions through block grants or whatever that may look like?
And do you feel like you're being heard?
Yeah, I do feel like I'm being heard. I have the opportunity, and every time I get in front of them, I'm speaking on behalf of Iowans. I'm advocating for Iowans, whether that's farming or manufacturers or the workforce. I mean, I've had the opportunity to serve on a couple of his boards, especially with the apprenticeship and with the workforce needs, not only in Iowa, but across this country. We're not unique. Every single governor is struggling with workforce, which means this entire economy in America is growing, and we're seeing great things happen because of that. When you reduce taxes and regulations and you really create an environment where companies and business owners feel optimistic about investing, that's good. And we're seeing that happen. We're seeing wages rise. We're seeing bonuses and investing in their company. So I think, you know, that's all positive, and I think we're going to continue to see that. We're seeing things happening with trade. He stuck his ground, and we're really seeing, I think, some bilateral agreements and the USMCA, the new agreement with Mexico and Canada is huge because that's our number one and two trading partner. And so it's really important to Iowa that we've got that done and we're moving forward. So I look forward to, you know, I meet with any of the presidents that come to Iowa. As a governor, I think that's absolutely what you should do. I look forward to him coming, and I'm hoping he's got another good announcement for Iowans.
So if you were to give him a grade, what would you give him?
Oh, I don't know. For the economy, I think he's done really well. I really do. And I think in Iowa specifically, I think, and then we've added to that with the historic tax cut that we did last year with, you know, to help Iowans keep more of their hard-earned money. For heaven's sakes, I understand what everyday Iowans are going through to make ends meet. Kevin and I had to do that when we were raising our three daughters. So I know that it's important that, you know, we let you keep more of your hard-earned money. It's gas. It's groceries. It's necessities. I mean, it makes a difference. It's not insignificant. So we've been able to kind of build on what they did at the federal level and excited about that. So as far as the economy goes, I think, you know, B plus A.
Other aspects that, I mean, Senator Joni Ernst has said in the past, you know, I wish he'd just stop tweeting or put the phone down.
Well, I think we all would say that that's probably would be helpful. I don't think there's anybody that wouldn't. Honestly, everybody needs to put their phone down. Everybody needs to put the phone down and let's start talking. We've lost the ability to have a conversation, you know, not only about things that we agree on, but things that we don't. And I have always been a big believer in that. I'm proud that almost every single piece of legislation that I supported this last legislative session passed with bipartisan support, and three major initiatives passed with unanimous support. Every single legislator, Republican and Democrat, voted for that. And I think that's what leaders do. They bring people together. They encourage the conversation and the dialogue. They encourage both teams to find common ground, to move the ball forward, not take your ball and go home. And I've done it. I've done it my entire life. And it's important. And it's missing in today's society. It is sad.
All right, Governor Kim Reynolds, thank you.
Thank you.
Clay Masters in conversation with Governor Kim Reynolds. And that does it for this edition of River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.